Hello, and welcome to Popcorn Science. In this podcast, we take a critical look at the science portrayed in our favorite movies and television shows. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Catherine Niche. I'm a planetary geologist and a fan of pop culture.
And I'm Dr. John Moores, a professor of space engineering at York University, a planetary atmospheric scientist, and just a great big speculative fiction nerd.
All right, so it's been a minute. We took a bit of a break. John and I were both pretty busy over the past few months. I actually had a chance to go to Africa for a few weeks, which was amazing, but it didn't leave us with much time to podcast. So here we are. We're going to start a new season. So this is officially season 2 of Popcorn Science, or episode 13, depending on which way you want to look at it. And so since it's an odd numbered episode, I got to pick the topic. And since we haven't done a ton of TV shows in the first season, I thought I would return to that medium, which is a big favorite for me. I love TV shows, and go to a series I only recently watched, which makes me a bad space nerd. But the series For All Mankind is one I only recently sat down and watched. I know it came out in 2019, but my introduction to it was actually just earlier this year, which is embarrassing, but I will blame it on cost. And honestly, this is just a problem with streaming services these days, right? You can't watch.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, you need every streaming service under the sun to watch all the new episodes. So I hadn't actually seen it until I purchased Apple TV to watch another series, the Silo series, which I'm also a fan of. And I was like, oh, look at this show. I should finally watch it. And then I did, and I binged it over the course of a couple of weeks. And I'm looking forward to season 5, which I couldn't find any information about it coming up. So we'll see when it's due to come out. But it's rare that we're talking about a show that hasn't already ended. For All Mankind has 4 seasons, and it does seem like it will continue for at least another season, if not more. So we're kind of in the middle of a TV show right now.
I think that the intent for this particular show is to go to 7 seasons. That's sort of what I've seen.
Yeah,
you know, online.
I read that too, kind of the Star Trek model. Yeah, we'll see if they make it there. That's going to be in the future by the time they get to 7 seasons, though, if they follow 1 decade per season. So it'll be interesting to see what they think the future is going to be.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things I used to enjoy when I would go down to JPL and visit with the Team X people is that they had prospective missions planned out to 200 years in the future. So I'm curious to see what this timeline thinks of going in that direction.
It is funny. Yeah. So to take a bit of a sidetrack here, people talk about these missions, like you said, 50, 100 years in the future. And I always have to chime in and be like, are we even going to be sending spaceships into space in 50 years? Like, we might have other issues going on at that point. Climate change, war, who knows? I think that's just, I mean, I like the optimism, but it might be a bit too optimistic sometimes.
So. I've got to have some optimism,
you
Catherine.
You do. And I do like that about this series, that it is a more optimistic view of the future than other people present in sci-fi. So we'll go with that. So obviously,
we'll get back
to that. Yeah, we'll get back to that. Obviously, we couldn't cover the whole series. There are about 40 episodes, if I'm doing my math correctly. And we're going to focus on the first 2 episodes of the 4th season, titled Glasnost and Have a Nice Soul. If you're not familiar with the series, For All Mankind represents an alternate future where the Russians beat the Americans to the moon in 1969, and basically the space race never ended. By the start of the 4th season, it's 2003, and humanity has settled both the moon and Mars. In these first 2 episodes of season 4, we follow the leaders of the Mars base as they attempt to capture and mine an asteroid for the first time, while also balancing the unique international social politics inherent in space travel. As my mother calls it, this is a space soap opera, basically, in a lot of ways. But it also has some interesting science, which we're going to talk about here.
So this red splotch here is where it's detecting methane gas.
Correct. Methane's a sign of possible life.
And these northern regions of Mars are riddled with these lava tubes, like you're simulating here?
That's right. Korolev Crater is one of the most likely places to harbor microbial life in the entire solar system.
Do you want to give a little background on your experience with For All Mankind, John?
Absolutely. This is a show I've known about for a while. I haven't been on board since 2019. I want to say it's been a couple of years since I started watching the shows, and I was able to watch this particular season in real time. And you're right, you know, it's a different experience. It's like, when's the next episode coming out? You know, I want to know what happens next. And I just remember, like, when I was watching and binging everything at the start, I got up to the end of season 3 and they have that reveal with Margot in Moscow. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh my God, you know.
I was so happy. Well done. I was so happy. I'm like, I have to hear her southern accent speak Russian. And they delivered, I've got to say. They delivered.
Indeed, and focused, of course, on two of the episodes of this one. But they take that to a really dark place that I was in government at the time, also felt very true, like disturbingly true. Mm. So,
you mean Margot's experience in Russia?
Oh, absolutely. And her, the way that she works with Roscosmos. There are little things in there. It's like, you know, you guys had some good science advice and good advice on the political culture. So I like that those, you know, grace notes are also done well in the show.
Indeed, indeed. But not everything is perfect in this show. So perhaps we should start with our first segment, which is our science gripes.
I will say, though, that compared to previous ones, we had, a little bit of a harder time. I mean, don't get me wrong. There are some really big goofs here, and I think we need to start with one of those. I think you really flagged, and I had this on my list as well, that way of moving around an asteroid. There's some choices there that are questionable.
Yeah, I was really curious to hear what you thought of this, because it seemed like the dumbest way possible to move an asteroid. Even so much, I found a quote from IMDb about it, which I'll get to in a second. So what they're doing is they found this asteroid, and they're trying to push it, I think, into Mars orbit. But they're doing that by taking a giant spacecraft, a little sort of tower, and then strapping the tower to the asteroid and pushing it. And on IMDb, one of the users says, attempting to push a large asteroid with a spaceship using a single long pole represents incomprehensible engineering incompetence. It ignores thousands of years of human experience with barges and trailers, as well as what every child learns when playing with blocks in kindergarten. So that was pretty scathing. I don't know much about the engineering, but it seemed all wrong to me. So I don't know. Do you want to talk about this, John? What exactly is wrong
sure.
with it?
Well, the other thing is I can see where this comes from, right? Because this person talks about challenges with all these old-timey vehicles. But the fact of the matter is today in aerospace, there is one vehicle that is, you know, very long and skinny that we push from the end, and that's a rocket. Mm-hmm. That's where the engine is. So folks thinking about outer space, you know, that's what's going to, they're going to have rockets on the mind. And when you think about like moving around one of these asteroids, it's like, oh, we'll just strap a rocket on it. Where you do that on the back. But it does create a problem that is inherently unstable, right? And you have to have the ability to correct that. And that does not seem to have been built in to this very well. Like, we'll talk more about reaction control thrusters later, but those tend to be towards the pointy end of the rocket. And in this case, they didn't seem to have any reaction control, any rockets further up on the asteroid. Everything was back on that one ship, which I think is a real bit of a problem. Now that said, you know, I like the idea of pulling it as well. But if you're pulling something in space, you have to make sure you don't hit it with your rocket exhaust or you go nowhere, which means that if you're pulling, it kind of annoyed me because, you know, having a tower is kind of what you need for pulling. For pushing, it doesn't seem to be critical.
Like you could just butt the spacecraft right up to the asteroid and push on it, right?
Exactly. And you'd think that would be more stable. So in this case, you know, if you were to pull, you'd have to angle your rockets out to the side, which means that some of the thrust is wasted. So if you were really talking about being efficient and you can control the asteroid well, then pushing is actually going to save you a little bit of that that propellant, a little bit of, you know, what we call delta V. So I can see why an engineer would have come up with this. It's more elegant in a way, but the problem they had is exactly the problem I'd expect.
Well, right. And the other thing that baffled me was that the problem, so they attach this tower to the asteroid with these long lines that are drilled into the asteroid with spikes, essentially. First of all, I'm not sure like meter long spikes are the correct way to attach a tether to an asteroid, because asteroids are rubble piles, so you're not going to get a lot of cohesion between the spike and the soil. It's going to be loose, and that's indeed what happens. It kind of jiggles out of place and pulls up, and they lose tension. But that was my other question. Why are the lines tensioning at all, pulling the spikes up? Shouldn't the pushing cause slack in the line? And you had a thought on this.
Yeah, as these things go unstable, you're going to have tension in some parts, and then that slack shows up in other parts. And I can imagine if the cohesion is poor, that could result in you getting this sort of reaction. I do wonder if putting ropes around an asteroid is a good idea at all, because like you say, they're rubble piles. So as you tension it up, maybe you just, you know, pull them through the asteroid like, you know, a gigantic, you know, cheese wire.
Yeah, so I did look this up. I was curious to see what NASA had proposed for capturing asteroids. And there was quite a push in the 2010s to capture an asteroid. That push has kind of died down, but it was called the Asteroid Redirect Mission, or ARM. And I heard a lot about this in scientific meetings in the last decade. It was proposed in 2013, eventually canceled in 2017. But what they were proposing was basically like a big net, but it was for a very small asteroid, something up to 8 meters in diameter. The asteroid they were pushing on in For All Mankind was much bigger. I couldn't figure out exactly how big, but it was, I would say it was several times bigger than the spacecraft, which I looked up, and that's 90 meters in length. So this asteroid was hundreds of meters in size. So it's not something you could just put a giant net around, like NASA was proposing to do with ARM. NASA did think about how they might collect a sample from a larger asteroid, like an asteroid of this size, and they just proposed lifting a large boulder off the surface, not pushing the entire mass. So I don't know if anyone has really looked into pushing an asteroid of this size, nor would you really need to, but I think we'll talk about that later.
Oh, yeah. In science fiction, I feel that most of what I've seen, at least lately, with asteroids of this size has been processing them in place and right. Then taking the process material and transporting it.
Yes, exactly. So I think we're going to get to asteroid mining here later. But the other thing that really galled me about this is they just had no idea how astronauts actually work. So they got a command to shut down the acceleration. That's the obvious thing to do when something goes wrong. And they just ignore it. So there's no way they should have let anyone go out to retension the lines. And then I'm not even sure they could have done that. I mean, it was just, there was no upside to this. They should have just shut down the engines, retension the lines, do whatever they need to do, and then start up again. To try to do it while they're still pushing on the asteroid was just insane and really ignored hundreds of years of engineering experience. And astronaut experience. No astronaut would do that.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's interesting, right? It makes me think back to like driver's ed a little bit. Like there's this this effect that gets talked about where initially people are very low in experience and they are very timid and very careful when they're out on the road. But then as they gain experience and they gain confidence, you enter this danger zone where how they think their abilities, their confidence in their abilities exceeds their actual abilities. And it kind of seems like it reminded me of that, the idea here that space travel and spacewalking is now common enough that people are willing to, oh, I'll just go out and fix that thing, as opposed to, you know, 15 meters of instructions of exactly which move to take where that you practiced in a tank in Houston. So they're in that stage maybe where their, you know, confidence maybe exceeds their abilities. I mean, they even put themselves in between things that are moving and that ends badly for them. And
yeah, you'd think at some point though their experience would catch up with them and they would no longer be in that danger zone. And like these astronauts have been around for decades, right? I mean, Ed Baldwin must be in his 60s at this point, right? So it's strange that somebody that experienced would be so reckless given everything that he's seen over the past few decades.
And there's no consequences for it either.
No, he's not demoted as XO. Right? That's the other thing that baffles me. They fire the station commander who told them the correct thing to do, but they leave Baldwin as the XO who made the mistake. It's strange. I mean, I know he's like the star of the show or whatever, but still not realistic.
Yeah, definitely a few people that feel almost embedded in the narrative and that make it stick a little less well. It reminds me of how everyone on the bridge always survives on Star Trek.
Right.
All sorts of crazy stuff.
Although I do appreciate For All Mankind's willingness to kill just about anyone. I think that's a Ron Moore thing. The same was true in Battlestar Galactica. All right. So that was probably my biggest science gripe. Is there anything else you want to say about that, John?
No. I think we have done a good job on that one. And I'm thinking maybe we should talk about the habitats.
Yes.
Because I think
that's
you and I have both been on
complaint.
We've both been on a City on Mars kick. So shout out here to the Wienerschmitts. And I think there's something that's not quite right about the way that they set this up. And in fact, I think when you looked into it, Catherine, the filmmakers knew that this was not quite right, but they were still attracted to the idea of it and the visuals.
Yeah. So for those of you not familiar, A City on Mars is a wonderful book, which kind of details how humans might live in space and how difficult it is. Totally recommend that book if you haven't read it yet. But one thing people have talked about on Mars forever, as long as people have been talking about settling Mars, is the fact that you'd be exposed to radiation on the surface, right? Mars has a tiny atmosphere that with no magnetosphere, so you're not really protected by the ultraviolet radiation or any charged particles coming from the sun. It would be a high radiation environment, which is not great if you don't want to get cancer. So basically, everyone proposes that humans would live underground on Mars. And they get this sort of half right. Most of the base is underground. You can see they have this elevator that goes to -1, -2, so forth, these different underground floors. But what's weird is that that's where the grunt workers live, right? The ones that they don't care as much about, whereas the aristocracy, right, the astronauts and the leaders of the base live on the surface, which seems backwards. I mean, nobody should be living on the surface, but especially the people in charge should be the ones protected from the radiation, you would think, because they're the ones in charge. So that's bizarre. And the other bizarre thing about it is just where they put the base. So they call it Happy Valley. In reality, it's a canyon called Melis Chasma, which is in the Valles Marineris Canyon system. If you've ever seen a picture of Mars, there's like this large tear around the equator. It looks like the Grand Canyon on crack. You know, it's just this massive canyon system on Mars. And a part of it is where they put this base. And I thought it was a weird place to put humans because it is quite close to the equator of Mars, which is great for power generation. You could have lots of solar power coming in, but it's nowhere near the ice resources you would need for a human base. So they do make this case in season 3, I think, where they find a water pocket and they're drilling for it. But that's not realistic. There's no evidence that there's either ice or buried water near the equator of Mars. All of the ice is near the mid-latitudes and the poles. Now, you can't live at the poles. It's too dark. It's too cold. That would be very, very difficult. So what people are currently looking at is maybe the mid-latitudes, where you might have some access to near-surface ice, but you also have sunlight for power and warmth. It seems really unlikely that they would have put their base here.
Photogenic, though. And it's interesting in thinking about where to send spacecraft. I remember there was a comment that I heard a couple of decades ago, early in my career, where people were saying, we keep going to boring places on Mars and we're losing the public. So this is definitely a pretty place. I second your idea of the mid-latitudes. If you go very far north, up near the polar ice caps, which are right on the surface, like you say, the cold and the darkness, but also a meter-thick layer of carbon dioxide ice freezes out in the wintertime over everything. And you would have to really build a bomb shelter of a base to get through that kind of of meteorology.
Yeah. Well, John can talk more to this because he was involved in this mission. But we did send one mission to the northern parts of Mars. It was called Phoenix. It landed there in 2008 at about 68 degrees north. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And it lasted through the summer, and they were hoping they might be able to turn it back on again after the winter time, but no one ever heard from Phoenix again. So presumably it got covered by ice and that caused some failure that prevented anyone from waking the spacecraft up again. Do you know more about that, John?
Yeah, we didn't build the spacecraft that could survive being encased in solid carbon dioxide ice, not just the temperature, but also the mechanical stresses that you'd have. Just for reference, that 68 degree north figure, think about like North Slope, Alaska, you know, in the northern territories of Canada, you know, even on Earth, that is not the most hospitable place.
Right, because like Earth, Mars has a 23 degree tilt. And so it's very similar in a lot of ways to Earth in terms of its seasons. Now, it is further from the sun, so the seasons are twice as long. So that makes the winter even more difficult to survive. But like Earth, it's tilted away from the sun during the winter. So you would have complete darkness there, in addition to extreme cold.
It is farther away from the sun, but it's not as far away as, you know, for all mankind seems to think that it is.
Yeah, that was a fun detail you picked up on, John.
Yeah, anytime they say a number, right, you got to go and check it. And sometimes there's an own goal that's being scored. And in this case, okay, the character involved is not portrayed as being the brightest person in the world. And they tell their wife, as they're about to go away, that Mars is only 145 billion miles away. And that is the distance of Mars. Close, not quite. It's about the distance of Mars on average from the sun. But from the Earth, it can be much closer. It can be much further, depending upon where Earth and Mars are in their orbits. So it was an interesting number to take a look at.
Yeah, I don't know why they picked that one specifically. And it was just very specific, too. How did he know that number? Maybe somebody just told it to him and he was just repeating it. I don't know.
Like that's the most charitable thing I can think of, is that maybe he wasn't paying fully attention in his briefing when they talked about how far Mars, you know, was from the sun on average, and just picked up the number. But it's a little weird. You'd think just saying, you know, I'll be hundreds of millions of miles away would be enough. But
Sure.
Very
sure,
specific.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. The other thing about Mars that I found a bit curious was their obsession with Korolev Crater, which is a real crater on Mars. Mm. It's an ice-filled crater near the North Pole at 73 degrees north. So this is part of the Arctic place of Mars where you'd find ice. So, but why they chose that, I think Kelly called it one of the most likely places to harbor microbial life in the entire solar system, which is a baffling statement for me as an astrobiologist. It is not the place I would pick to go to look for life. Now, she does correctly identify that methane is a good biosignature, and I think we'll talk about that more in Science Shine, but there's no evidence that there's methane coming from Korolev Crater. There's no evidence of any lava tubes in that region. The most northerly lava tubes on Mars, I think John found, was only 35 degrees north. They're mostly located in volcanic regions, which is what you'd expect, right? And those are mostly near the equator on Mars, a whole region called Tharsis, which hosts the solar system's largest volcano, Olympus Mons. So yeah, it was, I don't know why they chose this one crater. It's not near lava tubes. There's no methane emissions. Yeah, it has ice in it, but a lot of craters on Mars do. And later in the season, they do eventually visit Korolev Crater. But yeah, it was just a weird choice. If I were going to look for life on Mars, I'd probably focus on places where you might find ancient life, like NASA's been doing with Jezero Crater, and looking for evidence for life there. And a very spectacular paper just came out claiming that minerals found in Jezero might be consistent with life.
It's really fascinating, I think. Of course, For All Mankind focuses on human exploration. And there's this interesting interplay, I think, between scientific exploration and human exploration.
Yeah.
The series doesn't really get into science. This is like the first time that we've seen that, you know, oh, there are scientists who are also doing things and studying these places, because science isn't really the justification for why they're going to all these places. It's still very Cold War, very competition-based exploration type of work. And so this got me thinking whether or not science was proceeding in quite the same way in the alternate universe. You know, should we be thinking that it's going faster and they know something that we don't? Or should we be thinking that actually that's getting pushed more to the side and maybe they know less than we did in 03? But there was actually a big discovery about water in 03, or was thought to be water, with the gullies that were observed.
Yes, it was funny being a planetary scientist in the 2000s, because every other day it felt like there was some new claim of, we discovered water on Mars, over and over again. And the problem was there was just different lines of evidence pointing to past water on Mars, but every new press release was the same. So, you know, Mars Odyssey, which either launched or got to Mars in 2001, hence the name, call out to our last podcast on 2001, A Space Odyssey, discovered, you know, these large buried permafrost regions of ice on Mars. So that was, you know, really exciting. But then, as John said, we discovered morphological features of water, like gullies. And then later on, we found chemical evidence of water through the Mars exploration rovers. And so there was more and more evidence piling up in that decade that there had been past water on Mars, but it all just had the same press release. So I think we're done with that era. I think everyone agrees there was past water on Mars. Now the controversy is more, oh, well, was it warm and wet or cold and wet? And I think evidence is now going towards it being actually cold and wet. And so maybe Mars wasn't like Earth at all. It was covered in glaciers, and all the water there was sort of subglacial or very temporary. So that's sort of where the current research is headed.
It is very hard to tell exactly what was going on another body 4 billion years ago with detail. So
I mean, it's hard to tell what was going on. It was hard to tell what was going on Earth 4 billion years ago, and we're here, and
definitely,
we can poke at the rocks. So yeah.
I know, and we have to be. We don't have equipment that's quite as good, because we have to miniaturize it or otherwise change it, and we don't have as many hours or minds able to focus on the problem. So makes it challenging.
Yes, but interesting as a planetary scientist as well.
Definitely.
So one other big issue I had, so for the science gripes, to go back to the asteroid encounter, the very first time that Grigory Kuznetsov, the Russian astronaut, was doing an untethered EVA from the spacecraft Ranger to the asteroid. And I thought that was extremely risky. As we talked about in 2001, to launch yourself off a spacecraft with no tether is incredibly risky, right? You can get into a lot of trouble that way. Now, to his credit, he did have little thrusters on his spacesuit, so he could maneuver. And people have done that before. In 1984, Astronaut Bruce McCandless set the record for the furthest untethered spacewalk, which was 97.5 meters from the space shuttle using the manned maneuvering unit. But in this scenario, and mind you, the technology is better in For All Mankind than it was in 1984, but they said he was more than 100 meters away from the spacecraft. So that seems rather risky. Indeed, NASA agreed and stopped using the manned maneuvering unit after its first introduction. I think they only used it 3 times before they retired it from use. And now they use, or when the shuttle was still operational, they used a smaller one that was only intended for emergency use. Otherwise, you would be tethered. So even NASA thought that this was too risky. So I was kind of surprised to see them sending this astronaut out without a tether for such a long distance. Like, why couldn't they have gotten closer to the asteroid?
I mean, it's a good visual, I think. And you do see that. Like, we've talked about this a number of times on this podcast. You know, when the visual is really compelling, the filmmakers tend to go for it. And you've got that classic popcorn science issue here with untethered EVA. And of course, the also ever popular popcorn science, people making use of flaming pharmaceuticals in closed environments.
That's right. Yeah, I think we need to make like a list of all the inappropriate use of cigarettes, cigars, and marijuana in sci-fi. Because we have another example here. They show Ed Baldwin, the XO of the Mars base, at the end lighting up a little marijuana to enjoy at the end of a long day. But again, he's in a Mars base where they have to bring in and produce all their own oxygen. So I hope they have some good scrubbers there, or the whole place is smelling like pot.
Well, on that note, perhaps we'll leave the science gripes and we'll be back in just a minute with the science shine. Welcome back. And this week, we're taking a look at For All Mankind. And it's one of those shows that really tries hard to do the science well. And for that reason, I don't think we're going to get to cover all of the science shine that we identified. There's just so much really nice stuff here. We'll still hit the highlights, though. So what really stood out to you, Catherine?
You're right. They do a lot well in this show. So I do have to give them credit. I think it's clear that the creators of the show love space and did their research. They even put out their own little popcorn science YouTube videos hosted by Ren Schmidt for the third season, which I thought was pretty cool, where they try to explain some of the science that they're presenting in the TV show. So I think they care about it, and it shows. Let's see, what stood out to me the most? So as much as I hated how they were trying to push the asteroid, I think the asteroid itself and how the astronaut approached it was pretty realistic. The asteroid was dark. It was clearly an unconsolidated rubble pile, which is what most asteroids look like. You know, it gave me vibes of Bennu and Ryugu, the two asteroids that were visited by sample return missions. So it looked realistic. They also made it clear that it's not just the moon, right? Like the astronaut approached it sort of horizontally, right? He held his hand yes. out to slow himself down. And then when he slowed down enough, he had to use some sort of stick. I don't know if you figured out what exactly he was doing to hoist himself up into a standing position, because the gravity would be so low, you'd kind of have to tether yourself to it to stand up properly. So I thought that was pretty good. I appreciated the detail there.
Oh, definitely. I mean, having the asteroid as a wall, I thought was nice. There were a few scenes later on where you saw astronauts sort of standing on the asteroid, which I thought were less well done, but that initial contact
right.
was great. And I even took a look at the speed with which the astronaut was approaching, and it's only about 30 centimeters a second, so I can believe that you could arrest yourself with your suit hand like that.
Yeah, so they did well there. I also thought their communications were realistic. Right. So they're not just like talking to people back on Earth. They're sending them video messages and then receiving them later. And this is realistic because there's a huge time delay between Earth and Mars just because of the speed of light. And it's something like several minutes, depending on where Mars is in its orbit. So there's no way you could have a real-time conversation with anybody on Earth if you were sitting on Mars or vice versa. So I liked that touch, too, that they depicted the communications, I thought, rather realistically.
Well, getting into some of the audio stuff, one thing that I think everyone who's seen the series has picked up upon is it's the first series that I've seen that really does the sound of silence in space well. I mean, we learned in 1979, of course, that in space, no one can hear you scream, but they can't hear you do anything else either. And I just love the extended scenes in For All Mankind where you have stuff happening and it is completely quiet. No whooshing of spacecraft, no pew, pew, pew. Well, they don't have, you know, weapons, but at the same time, I just really love that that aspect of it is there.
Yeah, I didn't notice that, I think, as much as you did, but maybe because it wasn't distracting, so that was a good thing. Right, I think I've said in the past, the science that bothers me is when it's so wrong, it's distracting. It's not the science done well that bothers me, because I just don't even notice it sometimes.
I think for me, it's just that there are some extended takes when they're looking at things going wrong or something happening, and it's just all in quiet. And I guess I'm just used to the overstimulation, right? And, you know, you have that point where it's all visual, like it would actually be, and nothing's auditory.
Yeah. The other trope that we see in a lot of sci-fi is the rotating space station, and they have one in For All Mankind, too. This is Phoenix Station. That's in orbit about Mars. It was one of the spacecraft they took from Earth to get there. And I did the calculations. It seems like it rotates about once in about 40 seconds with a ring diameter of about 122 meters. I found that on some nerd site online. And I did the calculation. That gives you a gravity about 0.2 Gs, which is similar to the moon. But I think the creators knew that it wasn't quite right. They actually have quite a dramatic scene. I think it was at the beginning of season 3 where they have a hotel in Earth orbit that starts accelerating and going faster and faster until the gravity is crushing the people inside. And so
dramatic.
It was pretty cool. But they knew even then that it was rotating too slow. Because there's a podcast series you can listen to about the third season, and one of their technical advisor mentioned this, because they said if they'd actually been spinning at the correct rate to do 1G, like, you couldn't look out the window, it'd be dizzying. So they decided to go with a slightly slower and less realistic speed, but they knew what they were doing. It was more of an aesthetic choice than a scientific choice to slow it down a bit.
Yeah, it's the little details, I think, all of those things. And one that, that you picked up on a little bit is this idea that Mars has got a day that is very similar to an Earth day, mm-hmm. but is a little bit different, 37 minutes longer, 39 minutes longer, depending on exactly how you're counting this thing. And they actually handle that nicely. It's something you see throughout science fiction that involves Mars, this idea of what do you do with those extra minutes. You know, is it like the purge every day for 40 minutes? Or do you make your seconds longer? So this was something they actually tackled, which was nice.
Well, it was right there in the name of the episode, too. It wasn't have a nice day.
Exactly.
It was have a nice soul. And a soul is a Mars day, which is, as John said, you know, 37 minutes longer than an Earth day. So very similar, but just a smidge longer. And I was hoping you might know a little bit more about this, John, but I know that people who have worked on Mars missions, like MER and others, actually had Mars watches and lived on Mars time for the first few weeks of operations so they could be in sync with the spacecraft. Did you ever live on Mars time, John?
I've done that a couple of times now. I did that with Phoenix, and I did that with the Curiosity rover as well. And it's a real experience, I have to say. The Mars watches I saw less of. I think with Pathfinder and with MER, there were some watches that had been sort of hacked, and mostly people were sort of, you know, buying these from the aftermarket. But of course, now you can actually go, if you have more money that you know what to do with, you can actually go and buy luxury watches that have, you know, a Mars time complication. Timekeeping in space has always had this interesting relationship. You think about the moon watches from Omega, and then there's all these examples. We could do a whole podcast on that if we wanted to dive into that kind of side of things. But the actually being on Mars time is really kind of a neat experience. One of the things that I thought was really weird is when I was on Curiosity, I would be driving into JPL every day. And I got to tell you, 2:10 at 3 a.m. is fantastic. When you get to the parking lot, there's something that's in the sky at about the same place every day. And if you're keeping to a normal schedule, that's the sun, right? The sun's going to be, you know, over towards the east. For us, it was the moon, because the moon has its cycle every 29 days, and you're sticking on the Martian clock. You're going around the terrestrial clock somewhere in the mid-30s. So it's close enough that you see that weird sort of repetition. And some people do really well on Mars time. Like, I do really well on Mars time. We, during Phoenix, actually had psychologists in who were checking people's circadian rhythms. And mine's actually about 25 hours. So I'm a Martian. And I felt better working on Mars Time. But I can tell you, most people did not feel better.
Well, it's just so out of sync from everybody else, right? You know, you might be sleeping in the middle of the day. You might be up at 3 a.m., like you said. It's just all over the map.
And this is a benefit that I had, right? I was a grad student while I was on Phoenix, and I was a postdoc when I was on Curiosity. And I don't live in Los Angeles or in Tucson at the time. So I was flying in. And when I was there, I could be completely there. And aside from the driving back and forth to where I was staying from the Mission Operations Center, I didn't really have to sync up with the outside world in a significant way. And I could live on Mars Time, and that worked really well for me. But yes, there was definitely some use of coffee and other stimulants that took place. And as the missions wore on during the Mars Time phase, people started to look more and more haggard. But for me, it was great.
Yeah. Well, as someone with children, I can't imagine living on Mars Time while trying to send your kids to school and feed them dinner and so on and so forth. And I'm living that a little bit. My husband's a nurse, so he has these crazy night shifts and then has to somehow find time to sleep with children running around in the background. So yeah, it's not an easy thing to put your life on a different time schedule than most people on Earth.
No, it's a huge challenge. And I can understand for those people who are balancing, you know, the professional and the family, how hard that is. I was, like I said, very fortunate to be able to set myself up with conditions to actually be able to enjoy it a little bit. But those poor people who have like a 21-hour circadian rhythm.
Oh, yeah.
It just must have been torture.
I don't know. I've never tried it. I just stick with the same schedule every day, which is the Earth schedule. So maybe one day I'll have an opportunity. I really wouldn't want to live on Titan time, though, given that a day on Titan is 16 days long.
Yeah. That's the thing with Mars, right? Because it's close enough that we actually try to do this.
Right, right.
When we go to other planets, we never bother trying to live on their diurnal time scale because it's impossible.
Yeah, yeah. But anyways, I thought that was a nice touch that they did mention that. Another really nice touch that I wasn't expecting were the images inside NASA. So there's this scene where Danielle is talking to another astronaut in the hallways of the now Molly Cobb Space Center, formerly Johnson Space Center, which is also realistic. They have renamed NASA Space Centers before. So in the show, it was Johnson Space Center like it is today, but they renamed it to Molly Cobb because she was killed in an explosion that happened there. So anyway, so Danielle's talking to this other astronaut in the hallways, and you can see all these pictures, and it's really quite wonderful, the care they took with these pictures. They have a picture of JWST, the James Webb Space Telescope. Now, this is 2003. In reality, that spaceship, the first mirror wasn't installed until 2015, and it launched in 2021. So in this alternate reality, JWST was bumped up several decades, but you can see that. The other really cool picture I saw was of the Earth's atmosphere. So you can see a shuttle just on the limb of the atmosphere in space. Now, this is a real image taken in 2010 of the space shuttle Endeavour about to dock with the International Space Station. But what's cool is they actually replaced it with a silhouette of their space shuttle, their Pathfinder space shuttle, in this alternate universe, and used that silhouette instead of the silhouette of the Endeavour space shuttle. So anyways, I thought that was kind of a cool nod there. I also noticed they had these patches in the background. So there's another scene where Dale is talking to Ed Baldwin in the airlock, and you can see a few patches in the background for different spacecraft. And of course, I paused it and zoomed in and was trying to figure out what they were. And they look like real patches. One was for Perseverance, one was for the Mars Exploration Rovers, one was for the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. These are all missions that flew. I mean, obviously not in 2003, but these are missions that flew. Although it's funny, if you find the Perseverance patch online, it literally says Mars 2020, which is funny because this is 2003. Now, you can't actually see that because it's tiny, but if you zoom in way, way far, maybe you can see that the timeline's off. Yeah, anyways, I loved all these little details that they had just in the background that you could spot. Like I said, it's clear the creators really care about space.
And I love how so many of these work on more than one level, right? I used to work at the Canadian Space Agency. I can tell you that these space agency headquarters and centers do tend to have a lot of this sort of memorabilia lining the corridors and on the walls. And they could have just done spacey stuff that corresponded to the series. You know, here's our old shuttle, and here's, you know, our old thing. But what they've done in going and actually taking stuff from the real world and modifying it to fit in the new timeline. You've got that double reference there, which I thought was really nice. And having worked with the production designers, you know, back when I was on Clara, you know, just seeing, you know, how they pull so much from what's already out there and has been put together by folks from NASA and whatnot. You know, they're aware of these iconic images and these patches and the other artwork that's been done. And I think that there's an enjoyment there in being able to draw that in and have these Easter eggs just in the background.
Yeah, they do a good job with that. Another one I noticed was the Mission Control Center, which does look an awful lot like the actual Mission Control facility in Houston. And it has the same font. They just updated it. So it now says Mars Mission Control Center rather than Mission Control Center. So a lot of those little details you can find throughout the series. Very, very well done. So another thing I want to bring up is their discussions about astrobiology. So Kelly Baldwin is an astrobiologist. She's trying to find life on Mars. And though I question her choice of Korolev Crater as the ideal place to look for life on Mars, she does get a lot of it right. So they talk a lot about methane as a biomarker, and I'm sure John has a lot to say about this. But it is something people are interested with Mars because it can be formed through a process called methanogenesis. And so this is something that microbes do on Earth, where they convert carbon dioxide and hydrogen into methane and water. And so we see this with microbes on Earth, and we think, you know, if we are going to have life on Mars, it might be in the form of these methanogens. And so they might release something like methane, which could then be detected in the atmosphere. And indeed, there's a huge controversy right now about whether there's methane on Mars, how much methane is on Mars, and whether or not it's indicative of life. But they get that point correct. I don't know. Do you want to dive into this, John, or should we talk about that in another point in time?
Well, perhaps the main thing I'll say here is that one of the sources of the controversy, other than the measurements themselves and the fact that different spacecraft record different things, is that methane, even if it's existing, can be created in many different ways, right? You can take organic carbon that rains down on all of the terrestrial planets from comets and things like that, and you can convert that into methane with ultraviolet radiation. You can have hot water and rock reactions in the deep subsurface that can release methane as well through a process called serpentinization that creates things like asbestos. And you can also have ancient methane back when it was much more abundant on the surfaces of planets that's being released. So there's all of these ways that imply biology, but all of these ways that don't. And so it's a fascinating problem to really dig into, I think.
Yeah. So we won't go into that now, because that, again, could be a whole separate podcast unto itself. But she's also right that you would want to look in lava tubes for life. This is a reasonable place to look for life. They're not at Korolev Crater, but if you're looking for life, you could go find a lava tube on Mars. What's great about lava tubes is they're underground, so they'd be protected from that radiation we were talking about earlier that might destroy biological molecules. They might have a higher pressure than the surface. They might be more likely to harbor liquid water. Volcanic minerals there could provide a source of nutrients for organisms. So there's a lot to be said about looking for life in lava tubes. So that's correct. And she has her little robot dog to go explore the lava tube, which looked very similar to the ones produced by Boston Dynamics, which they even call Spot, like she did. So I thought all these little details were pretty good and, you know, winked at some of the actual science that's being done to study life on Mars.
There's so many of these little details which are done really well. I love the folksy administrator who is very keen to pull out, you know, back when I was in charge of, what was it, Chrysler or something? It was one of the big car companies.
Yeah.
I remember.
I can't remember which company it was.
You know, you've got that very subtle thing that reminds you that the administrator is a political appointee. He's not someone who worked their way up from NASA's mailroom or anything like that. Maybe not even somebody who's particularly passionate about space. Although, who isn't passionate about space? Come on. So there's these little things, and they weave their way in, right? The importance of communications and food to morale. The fact that the communication satellite isn't designed to be fixed by astronauts. I mean, you kind of forget about that because some of the big telescopes that have gone up have intended to be serviceable by astronauts. But most satellites are never meant to be touched again, and it would be very, very painful to go and do this kind of a repair like we see there. And I enjoyed seeing a very common phrase that you run into in policy circles in space, the idea of, you know, no bucks, no Buck Rogers. So I traced that line back, and apparently it comes from the 1983 film, The Right Stuff.
Excellent
so we
movie.
Can be confident, even in the alternate universe, The Right Stuff still
Excellent.
Got made.
Excellent. It's interesting you bring up the Folksy Administrator, because that was actually one of my gripes that we didn't talk about. In For All Mankind, they sort of mix up the NASA Administrator and the JSC like Center Director in this weird way.
Yes.
And they do this throughout the series. The NASA Administrator does not live in Houston, right? They're based out of Washington, D.C. As John said, they're a political appointee. And so I don't know why throughout the series they have that person kind of live in Houston and basically act like the center director there, when NASA has centers all over the country and the NASA Administrator has to be in charge of all of them. So I thought that was a weird detail. I think I know why they do it, just to make that person more involved in the plot and the characters, but it's not correct. And they also have no control over the budget, which they seem to imply in this episode that somehow he's slashing the budget. The administrator doesn't control that. Congress does. So there are some weird details. And I think I know why they do them, but it's a bit off-putting for somebody who works in these spaces.
Yeah, that simplification, I think we saw that. Like, the biggest offender on this was actually, you know, one of our favorites, Contact, where,
oh, right, yeah,
you know, you actually have the characters in the first half of the movie and the second half of the movie should be different, but they're not. And you want to keep that continuity. I think it's the same thing here. And I will say, you and I, we know better, Catherine, but I know plenty of people who blame the NASA administrator when things go badly.
I guess that's true. Yeah. Well, that's, again, another whole podcast, which I don't feel like we should delve into right now, but especially given the state of affairs in the United States right now.
Absolutely fair. So before we go on to the interesting, in this case, of its time, is there anything else that you want to just talk about?
Yes, there was one big thing I did want to talk about before we move on to For Its Time, and that's asteroid mining. And I don't actually know if this is a science gripe or a science shine, but the whole point of them dragging that asteroid back to Mars was to mine it, to make money, to support the space endeavor, I think. They make some allusions to the fact that they need money to support themselves. No bucks, no Buck Rogers, right? But whether or not asteroid mining would actually be financially feasible is a big question mark. People have been talking about this for decades, and it's true that there are a lot of rare metals on asteroids like iridium and platinum that would go for thousands of dollars per ounce on Earth. But mining an asteroid is incredibly difficult, much more difficult than mining on Earth, and it might not be worth the effort. You can source a lot of these resources on the planet itself, and so you don't have to go out into space. And then if you do go into space and bring all this, say, platinum back to Earth, now you're flooding the market and maybe it's not worth thousands of dollars an ounce anymore. So there's a lot to be said about whether or not asteroid mining is feasible and financially profitable, not to mention if it's ethical or legal. We're bound by space law. This is a whole field of study, which is fascinating, by the way, if you ever want to look into it. And it's mostly based on the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, which was put together by the UN, I believe, and has been signed by 115 countries. Now, this doesn't directly talk about whether or not it's legal to mine space, but it does say that we should treat space as a commons, but doesn't specifically talk about its resources. So a lot of people have interpreted this to mean that mining is fair game. There's another treaty that nobody signed, the 1979 Moon Agreement, that specifically says the moon's natural resources shouldn't become anyone's property. But it's only been signed or ratified by 18 countries, so which does not include the United States, China, or Russia. So basically, people want to be able to mine things in space, and I think they're willing to manipulate any treaty to make that the truth.
You've got these international treaties to try to control these things, and even on the Earth, it's very difficult. The Antarctic Treaty, the Law of the Sea and whatnot, that you have people trying to lay claims to areas that aren't actually developable right now, but might be in the future. And with the asteroid mining thing, you've got the idea that, at least the way that it looks, sending this material back to Earth or sending it to Mars doesn't seem to be the best way to use it. It's actually going to be other space habitats that really are going to value this material. And that's probably where you would end up sending it. If you were sending things back to the Earth, you've got potential for some bad stuff. I believe, Catherine, you study impacts and large objects being sent through the atmosphere. There are a number of science fiction series where asteroid mining turns into a planet being essentially held for ransom or being attacked by the shipments being sent back, being, you know, pushed off course a little bit.
Yeah, there's just so many dangers with this. And you might not even make any money. Right? There was an asteroid mining company called Planetary Resources. They announced it with a ton of fanfare in 2012, and it folded in 2018 because it couldn't make any money. And when you look at it, you know, the most amount of mass we've brought back from an asteroid is 122 grams. And that cost $1 billion. That was the OSIRIS-REx mission to the asteroid Bennu, right? It's not a financially viable way. It's dangerous. I mean, I see what they were getting at here as a way to make money for Mars, but I think it's pretty unrealistic in the near term, at least.
A lot of these economic schemes are difficult, right? We've seen helium-3 mining on the moon, which is not useful now. And a lot of these companies, like with Planetary Resources, they sold time on their telescopes so you could turn them around and figure out whether your neighbor's fence was in the right place. And a few other companies out there, especially ones hoping to go to the moon, a lot of their financial upside was disposal of human remains, you know, to take those into space because they're very light.
Interesting.
And people are willing to pay.
Well, there we go. Okay. Well, that was just the last thing I wanted to discuss. Any final thoughts before we move on?
Well, the last thing I think I would say is I enjoy the social science side of this as well. The idea that once you get a bigger space station or a station on another planet, you're going to need support workers. And those support workers are not always treated the same as the astronauts that came before, and they may not be doing it for the same reasons. There's this wonderful scene in the episode that we looked at where you've got one of the astronauts and one of the support workers, and there's just this mismatch there. Like the support worker's there to make a buck, to try to make life better for his family, and he's being kind of prevented from doing that. And the astronaut basically says, look, you're on Mars, right? You know, you're doing something that's amazing, you know, be part of the cause and be happy about doing that no matter how hard it is. So they're there for completely different reasons. And that really, that thread really gets pulled at in the later episodes of this season. I enjoy that.
Yes, no, it's very good. I also like the juxtaposition of the, just how they look. All the support workers are in these drab grays living underground. All the astronauts are in colorful outfits, you know, living it up on the surface, watching soccer and eating fancy meals. So that, yeah, they make that pretty clear in the show. And I appreciate that too.
And such a reversal from the previous season, because the Helios ones in the previous season, they were the ones.
That's right. You know, with the fancy meals.
Exactly. And, yeah. So there you go. Well, let's leave this topic for now. We'll be right back in a minute with the Of Its Time, which is interesting for something made so recently.
All right. So now we're into our last segment, the Of Its Time segment. And this is a really curious one because it was filmed in August of 2022. So quite recently, it was released in late 2023, just 2 years ago. But it's set in 2003, so more than 20 years ago. And so really, I think we should talk about the Of Its Time for 2003, perhaps. Because I think that's, they are trying to play it up too. I mean, that's part of the aesthetic of the show, is they really try to play up the decade it takes place in. Season one is in the 70s. Every season is a decade later. And so you get a little taste of each individual decade. And so this one they're highlighting is the 2000s, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And they do play that up. There's this huge segment at the beginning of the first episode where they kind of cover everything that happened between the last season and this season, between the late 90s and the early 2000s. And so there's lots of fun Easter eggs in there. I don't know. Did you have any favorites from that segment, John?
Well, I kind of feel like this is something on which we disagree a little bit. So let's dig into this. So, you know, a lot of science fiction these days is very pessimistic. And, you know, that can get overwhelming, you know, that dark aesthetic and things going wrong and things breaking down. And the news in the world is always very concerning. I do enjoy Star Trek, of course. We've said this many times. I feel like I say it every episode. And one of the things I like there is the optimistic future. This one is very optimistic as well. It seems like the Russians getting to the, or the Soviets, I should say, getting to the moon first seems to fix most things that went wrong from 1969 onwards. And for me, even though it's positive, it kind of feels a little, I don't know, like the term for it, you know, in anime would be fan service. The idea that this is something that you're a little bit gratuitous that you're giving to the audience, because it is shocking the number of things in there that go so much better than they did in actual history, you know? Everything from getting electric vehicles to solve the climate problems in the 80s, the Equal Rights Amendment getting actually passed, you know, Al Gore actually winning the 2000 election. So there's all of these things in there, you know, just little gifts for the audience. And I know for me, it doesn't hit quite right. It's sort of like, there's a short story by Kim Stanley Robinson, if you'll allow me just for a second,
yep,
where he imagines that the pilots of the Enola Gay, which dropped the bomb on Hiroshima back in 1945, that they elect not to actually drop it. And he imagines history from that point, this is an alternate history, turning out so much better. And I guess I just don't have that level of faith in human nature. So you felt differently about this, Catherine. I mean, I think you enjoy the manufactured footage of things going well.
Yeah. I mean, I do like to see optimism in sci-fi because I feel so much of it is so dire and pessimistic. And in reality, I feel that way more and more. Although I think I've always naturally been an optimistic person. So it's nice to see a TV show what our future could be, right? That's not as bad as what it perhaps is in reality, to give us hope that things could be better. But I don't think it's unrealistic either. So to go back to the third season, right, where Ellen Wilson is president and she's a closeted gay person, and they essentially just pass Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the same thing that Clinton did, even though she and her husband are both gay. Or things like Danielle being really disappointed in her fellow astronaut when he comes out live on the radio. I mean, the 90s were very homophobic, but I think they portrayed that rather well. Mind you, they accelerated it a bit with Ellen coming out in the late 90s. It accelerated people's acceptance of LGBTQ community by a few years. But, you know, I do think they do consider the cultural milieu that the different episodes are taking place in, and they're not trying to speed it up too much. The thing that really bothers me is actually the fact that they invent fusion and it just fixes all their energy problems. That to me seems pretty unrealistic. But culturally, I can see how it all fits in.
I do like that actually gets a larger treatment. Like in the third season, yeah, I think it was, that's where they show, you know, all of the oil workers being put out of work.
Right.
And that leads to the bombing of the Johnson Space Center. And that thread continues on here in that now you've got all of these people that, you know, are being kind of forced to go into the industry that destroyed their previous jobs if they want to continue to make a buck. And I do like that deeper one is explored in more than just the headlines, because it could have easily been something at the start of the season and then never seen again.
Right, right. When they first bring it up in, I don't know, season two or three, I'm like, oh, this seems a bit unrealistic. But yeah, they eventually do address it in quite a bit of detail in seasons three and four. So I appreciate that. So, and you know, like I said, I kind of like to see an optimistic future. I like to see a future where Harvey Weinstein gets charged with sexual assault and John Lennon survives, you know, and Al Gore is president, while still retaining things like Survivor and all those terrible reality TV shows from the 2000s.
Jerry Maguire. Oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I don't know if you judge the shows that do better with science a little bit more harshly than the ones where it's not a consideration.
It's a good question. I don't know. I've never considered that, because I do really care about the social political system in the background that is driving the science. And so I do notice that that's done well. I don't know if I notice it differently in a show where the science is better. But maybe those things go together, just if you have more thoughtful creators and ones who aren't just out to show lots of explosions.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say is I am curious how they proceed with the story in Russia, though. Because in this universe, Gorbachev does not end the Soviet Union, essentially. He's still in charge of the Soviet Union. He's just leaning into these ideas of glasnost and perestroika. But during season four, you can see that there is this revolution underway in Russia. And I'm not sure it's really ever completely tied up with a neat bow at the end of season four. So I'll be curious to see where they go with that. They're even starting a new show called Star City, which will focus more on the Russian cosmonauts. So that'll be interesting. So, and in that way, I think the future is a little bit, you know, at least in Russia, in this show, is a little more pessimistic, right? Margot's getting beat up on the streets of Russia, and there's still a lot of tension politically, right, between the different countries, not just Russia and the U.S., but also North Korea. So I'll be curious to see how they, where they go with that. There was a nice touch, though, with the inclusion of Swan Lake in this, in I think it was Have a Nice Soul, which is what I guess Russians typically put on TV when a revolution is underway and they don't want to share the news. So this is a reference to a real life attempted coup in the Soviet Union in 1991. They put Swan Lake on TV to fill the airtime while they're carrying out their coup, and also followed the deaths of prominent Russian leaders to fill airtime while they were electing a new leader. So anyways, that was a kind of a nice touch there. But like I said, it'll be curious to see where they go with the Russian storyline.
Yeah, especially because that does get very heavy mm-hmm. later in this season. And it was not a place as a viewer, like it felt true, but it was also not sort of a place that I really enjoyed inhabiting. It, I think, hit a little close to me, and parts of it are quite hard to watch. So it'll be interesting to see the direction that they want to go with that. Hopefully, it'll come back to the optimism that we see in a lot of this this series.
I hope so, too. Because, like I said, I appreciate the optimism in For All Mankind that we don't see in a lot of series, especially Ron Moore series. Battlestar Galactica was not very optimistic. Anyways, there were a couple little touches I liked that reminded me of the 2000s too. The reference to Guitar Hero, Aleta's stuck at home playing Guitar Hero, which was a staple of the 2000s, although not technically released till 2005. So we know in this universe they've accelerated their video gaming, which I appreciate. And then that song that's being played when Danielle and Dale are in that split screen that you're talking about, where they were contrasting the lives of the astronaut with the support workers, is a song by the Gorillaz, which were a popular band in the 2000s. I didn't know. This song is actually called Clint Eastwood, which is weird because that's not mentioned in the song at all. It's da da da, I'm feeling glad I got sunshine in a bag. I'm useless, but not for long. The future is coming on. That song. I mean, everyone who was born, you know, in the 80s and grew up during the early 2000s knows that song. So it was a nice blast from the past, in addition to all those references we were talking about earlier.
They do lean on the nostalgia, right? Like, there's a lot about this that reminds me of things like Forrest Gump, right? Where they lean into that.
That's right. Yeah. That's
and
right.
If you completely rewrote history, you wouldn't have those notes to hit.
That's right. So they do stick pretty closely to the timeline with a few additions that didn't actually happen.
So I think this is a really interesting series. They're trying to get these things right. They've got really good science advisors and people weighing in, which we'll talk about in a minute. With all of that effort, how do you think that the series is going to age? If we look back in this in 10 or 20 or 30 years, how do you think it's going to look, Catherine?
My gut feeling is that it will age well, at least the decades that take place in the past. I'm very curious to see what they predict for the future. That has the potential of not aging as well if they totally misrepresent what the future holds. But for these seasons, yeah, I like it. I think they do have a keen eye for detail. And even if some of the things are a little bit wrong in the future, I think overall they got the tone right. And I think that will translate through the years. How about you?
I think you're right there. I feel like with the properties we've looked at in the past, when they have that kind of attention to detail, they have aged well. I think with 2001, I mean, we had complaints, but compared with things that had been made more recently than that one, I think we had fewer complaints about how well it had aged. So I think that's a pattern that we're starting to see, having done, you know, 12 of these episodes now, that when that kind of effort is there, it gets rewarded years, decades later.
Right. I mean, there's kind of two ways you can approach this, right? Some shows are ageless, right? You just take out any reference and it can just sit at any point in time. And that's a good approach, right? That I think those series age well. Or you can do the opposite here, where they really lean into the nostalgia and try to get it correct. And as long as you do that well, I think that can age well as well. It's where it's in between, like when you throw in references but don't consider them too closely. I think that's where the problems arise.
Definitely.
All right. Shall we move on then to our final ranking?
I'm good with that. Let's head over there.
Okay, so here is where we rate the TV series. We're going to rate it in three ways on a scale of 1 to 5. We're going to rate it on its scientific accuracy, its influence, and how does it hold up. So, John, what did you give it for scientific accuracy?
I know we had science gripes. I know there are a few things that we didn't love here, but of all of the properties out there and all of the things that we've looked at, I think this is amongst the best. So even though it's not perfect, I'm willing to overlook that and give it a 5.
High praise. I was a little bit lower in my ranking. I gave it a 4. I agree with John that they do a lot well, but I think the things they do wrong, they do very wrong. And I'm not sure why they did it that way. They could have easily changed it and fixed those problems. So I could not give it a 5, but overall they do well. I just wish they had fixed those big problems that we pointed out earlier.
It's hard though, right? Because when you think about these things, it's sort of like if they do everything perfectly, there'd be a lot less dramatic tension, right? And when you look back at the history of space exploration, as some of our colleagues have done, there's a lot of things that in retrospect were unfortunate or dumb or goofs or whatnot, just because they didn't have access to the same information we do now. So I don't know. I guess I just don't ding them quite so hard for that.
All right. Fair enough. How about its influence? It seems like we might disagree here as well.
So I think this is an interesting question, right? Because if you're talking about the overall influence on society as a whole, I think what you might hear from Catherine in a minute might be a little bit more accurate. But I have to say that at least within the scientific community, within people who spend a lot of time thinking about these things and are familiar with space, it is very influential. And even when I talk with filmmakers and documentarians and reporters, they all know this series. They are really impressed with it. And they're always very keen to tell me, you know, oh, I have, you know, like a friend or a family member who worked on this show and it was such a treat and whatnot. So I have to say, at least in terms of the people that I run into in my daily life, which is not the best example of influence, it's very highly influential. And it's a hard question, right? It's only been around for a couple of years.
So John gave it a 4 out of 5. I gave it a 2 out of 5 because, yeah, you really don't hear people on the street talking about it. I myself, as a giant space nerd, didn't watch it until earlier this year, right? Even though it had been on air for 6 years at this point. Now, the show is excellent. I'd recommend anyone who hasn't seen it should go out and watch it. I blame this mostly on the streaming services. If it was just available on network TV, as it would have been 20, 30 years ago, I think everybody would have watched it, right? But the fact that you have to sign up for all these different platforms and pay extra money for them, I think it just limits people's exposure to these shows. And so I think any show going forward is going to have a lower influence unless it can somehow spark the interest of the whole society, but that's difficult. And I worry about my kids, right? They're not going to have any of these cultural touchstones that they can relate to other people their age, because everyone just watches their own favorite show by themselves in their basements, right? And so there's not just that one show everyone watched together and can talk about.
Even with us science nerds, I think that one of the joys of doing this podcast with you is us being able to show each other what's been impactful for us and what's really been interesting. And so it's not uniform even within the community. But thinking about influence, there's different kinds of it, right? There's changing the conversation or really reaching and becoming a cultural phenomenon for a large number of people. There's also the idea of, you know, sort of pushing on the fulcrum at the right place. I feel what's interesting with this particular show is that you're right. Broadly in society, this is not something that everybody is talking about. It's not changing the conversation. But I feel like the people who will make a difference in space travel and those people who might actually carry out some of this stuff or want to push it forward, those people know about this. So it's interesting, right? It makes it difficult because the folks who might enact this future know it and know it well. But generally, society, not so much.
Although that begs the question, do we want people like Elon Musk watching this show, or are they getting the wrong message from it? So our last segment, our rating is how does it hold up? And I think both John and I put a little dash in this line, because I don't think we can say how it holds up yet. It's still being produced. We don't know what the future will make of it. I think we already talked about how we predict it will hold up. But for the moment, I think we're going to leave this segment blank, unless there's anything else you want to add, John.
I think that our predictions based on what we've been seeing now that we've been taking this systematic look at the genre, that's kind of the best we can do here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's all for our first episode of season two. We'll be back in a few weeks with a new episode on a new movie or television show. So until then, hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob.
Popcorn Science is hosted by Catherine Niche and John Moores, with Catherine taking the lead on pre-production, sourcing clips, and writing show notes, and John taking the lead on post-production and sound editing. Artwork for the show is provided by science illustrator Michelle Parsons, while Sean Nock handles web hosting and ensures that our conversations make their way to your favorite podcasting service.